Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composers Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Neil Parfitt's wonderfully diverse career sees him working at the highest levels as a composer for animated series, as well as designing custom synth sounds for some of the biggest blockbusters on the planet. He started out as a kid who was equally fascinated by how music was produced as he was with the technology that was used in the process. Neil began his scoring journey in anime with titles like Back Again, Battle Brawlers, and Beyblade. This multiple Canadian Screen Award nominee is now known for his music on series such as Ranger Rob, The Remarkable Mr. King, and Bravest Warriors, where he writes everything from Golden Age orchestral film music to 80s cheese to chiptunes. We talk about his early days figuring out how things work by dismantling them, getting his start in Toronto as a dialogue editor, how dogged persistence led to his entry into animation with Nelvana, working with Japanese creators on anime shows and adapting to musical cultural differences, a terrifying surprise meeting while he was on vacation, the joys and challenges of working on animated series where you have to, quote, turn on a dime and produce a million different cues, unquote, becoming an accidental YouTuber, and being terrible at self-promotion. Heads up, this episode does contain a bit more strong language than usual. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy this hilarious and enlightening episode with Neil Parfitt. Neil, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Adrian.
Got the radio voice going already. I love it.
Oh, hello.
All right. So the last few podcast episodes, we've been lucky enough to actually be able to do in person. And this is the second one where we're in another pandemic studio build, which is looking really, really, really great and sounding really great. What spurred you to change the venue and change the sort of like the way you had it going on? And what were you sort of after in terms of like what you wanted out of your studio versus what you had?
Ah, we got to go back a little bit. So just for anybody who didn't know, my studio was in my garage for 8 years. And I just felt as time went on, it was just little things like bio breaks in the middle of winter, having to trudge through the backyard, slipping on ice, stuff like that. And I'm also a bit of a gearaholic, and I felt the room kind of closing in on itself. So I felt it was time to do an expansion, and for years I've wanted to expand my house, and everything kind of aligned that a bunch of shows were ending, and I was like, okay, I have 6 months where I can press pause and get this all done. And I kind of planned it all that way, and sure enough, as soon as the studio was ripped down, another job came in, and I was working out of my kitchen for about 7 months.
Oh my God.
But at the end of the day, there's a purpose-built space in my house now that's about twice the size of the original, and it's just more breathing space, and there's windows for the first time. I've never had windows while working, and there's sunlight.
Yeah.
You know, I can see trees,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. I've just never had sunlight before while working.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I've always been like this weird hybrid hamster vampire.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, I work at night.
Hamster,
you know,
vampire.
Yeah, the phone doesn't ring, people leave me alone,
right,
and I can actually just focus for a long time on working.
Yeah,
but working in a studio like that, and it was even like that in my commercial space before I had the
right
window. It's kind of like, did you ever work at a mall when you were a teenager?
No, I actually never did.
Okay, well, just the lowdown for me was, you'd get there in the morning, it was dark.
Right.
You'd work in the mall.
Yeah,
you'd
yeah,
have
yeah
no sunlight.
Yeah.
And when you'd leave, it was still dark. So
right,
I always just felt like I was like in Dark City or something.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So you just never, the passage of time would sort of be that whole like sunlight thing.
Yeah. And because I go to bed late, I almost live every day twice in a weird way. Go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then you wake up on the same day the next day.
Yeah.
And then it just rinse, wash, repeat with no sunlight. You're kind of like, what year is it? I don't
That's
know.
That's still what you're doing now. You sort of have that kind of a schedule where you're getting up later and then going later?
Yeah.
You've always done that?
I've always been like that. But it actually works out because with some composer clients I work for, by the time they're done for the day,
yeah,
I just sort of pick up and keep going. Oh,
okay.
So
okay,
it kind of just, it creates an easier cycle
because mm-hmm
I'm not waiting around. Like what I need to keep going is ready. So yeah.
But are you kind of a night owl anyways? Like
yeah,
you feel like you're more creative at night?
Yeah.
Your commercial space was, you're talking about the one that was in Liberty Village, right?
So I did have a bunch of commercial locations,
mm-hmm,
you know, not at the same time, but
yeah,
I'd go
yeah
from one to the other. And I was kind of early kind of beginning career. I'm like, this is a lot of money to outlay. And even in the short time I've been in this, clients are coming less and less.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're like, oh, yeah, just send us a QuickTime. And meanwhile, I'm just getting into this, living in Toronto, I have a commercial lease and I have rent somewhere else. And it just got to a point where I was like, this is stupid. I should be putting this money into my own pocket.
Yeah, sure.
And that's when I decided to move my studio home.
Okay.
And then you have sort of those tax benefits as well, et cetera, et cetera.
So that was the main reason for you to have a commercial space, is so you'd have a place for clients to
exactly.
come over and do reviews and stuff like that. That's interesting, right? Because I think we, or at least people that are emerging, they'll look at other composers as sort of the models, and like a real composer will have this and a real composer will have that. I mean, there are composers that literally just have a laptop and a little MIDI, like 61.
Yeah.
61, that's it.
It's like the Matrix. They're everywhere and nowhere.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But I noticed that trend even when I was getting going. Like, I saw the transitioning happening. And I used to work at a music store, and you'd see all these people building up their home studios, and they sort of outspec the commercial places they were renting.
Right.
And that's where the writing's on the wall. It's like, who are you doing this for? Your clients who never come? Are you doing it for your clients who never come? Yeah. Or are you doing it for yourself so you're in this creative space that you're happy working in all the time?
That's right. Yeah, so. That's so true. The vibe thing, and that's certainly something you had in your other spaces that I visited, and this one for sure is this. It's got the vibe. It's very you. Like, everything around you just makes it, like, there's no question that this is Neil's place.
Now, that could just signify that there's this crap all over the place everywhere.
It's very well organized. I wonder, you obviously have an interest in design, right? Like
visual design?
Yeah.
I have no training, but I feel like I can tell when things are out of sorts.
Yeah.
You know,
because it never looks junky. It just looks like it's like a curios shop or something.
There's
like,
this collection. Yeah, there's collections everywhere of things, but it's organized chaos. I'd say. I can quote my mom on this. When she walked into my studio for the first time, and verbatim, she said this, so I don't think you have to beep it, but she just like stood in the studio. She just looked around and she's like, what the fuck is all this stuff? And that's when I realized, like, huh, maybe I have issues with studio tech and whatever.
Well, for anyone who knows you, they and certainly following you on Facebook or wherever, they know the massive wall of modular that is yours. Certainly when you were in the space in your garage, I looked at that space, and again, I can see where you felt like the walls were closing and there was so little space, and you had this massive, like, curving, because you have this thing that sort of curves up and over top of you.
Yeah, it was sort of a half pipe, and one time I had clients making jokes like, you know, you should create some sort of contraption so it can just rotate across the entire ceiling. And I was like, oh, I actually pondered it. I was like, huh. And actually, it was funny. It was David Fetterman who said, in your new space, you should just make a Lazy Susan for your entire rig. Just have the whole thing on a Lazy Susan.
Yeah, or like a hidden wall that sort of spins around and all the gear comes in.
Oh, place. That'd be so cool. Yeah.
It reminded me literally of the command module, like looking at like the Apollo 11 or something, where you just like have the gear literally curving right around the astronauts.
I think it might stem from, you know, my training and like in my band days when as a teen, I was still going to like the big facility studios, and you know, that's where I kind of fell in love with all this stuff.
Right.
Going to those big places and being like, oh, what is all this stuff? How does it all work?
Yeah.
And I want some of it at some point in my life. And now I'm in a position where I can. So I'm kind of like, okay, let's do this.
That's awesome. So going back though, like to those days and maybe a bit before, like if it seems to me that like you had an interest in technology and like computers and like building stuff and figuring out how programming worked and all this stuff. How did that all develop and how did music sort of fit into all that?
From an early age, I was always into this stuff. My dad worked in radio and my mom was in theater.
Okay.
So there was the creative sides of the family.
Yeah.
But they also knew I was really into taking stuff apart.
Okay.
And even from the early days, I'd take apart Transformers and I couldn't figure out how to put it back together.
Wait, when you say Transformer, you don't mean like the toy?
No. Yeah, the toys. I'd take them apart. I'd be like, how does this, I want to figure this out. And I'd take them all apart.
Yeah.
And then inevitably I'd get lost and I'd be like, I got to hide this from my parents. And I'd flush it down the toilet. And actually, just a side story, about 10 years ago, we were up in Aurora where I grew up. And the house we grew up in was for sale. And my mom was chatting to them. And then my mom mentioned just in passing, like, oh, yeah, we used to own this house. And their face just dropped. And they're like, we spent $10,000 in plumbing.
Oh, no.
We found toys all jammed through the stuff.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, that was me. But that's got me to where I am today. But my dad would bring home all these stereo systems and like dual cassette decks, and some of them would let you play tapes at the same time. So before I even had a multi-track recorder, I'd try recording a performance to one tape and then another tape and hitting play on both at the same time and then like playing that out to another tape, and everything was out of sync. But that's sort of where it all started. And there's one moment I still remember to this day where they gave me an old TV to take apart.
Okay.
And I'm amazed I'm not dead, because think of the capacitors in those things. Like, my parents would have no idea.
Yeah.
And here I am just like opening this up, and I was like, wow, I'll just touch all this stuff. No problem.
They have those warning labels on the outside of this. This is warning, risk of electric shock. But I always thought that's if it's plugged in.
Sometimes it can take days for those to discharge.
Wow. So, okay.
Yeah. But same. That's how I have my hair I had throughout my career.
Right.
Going back to school, I was always like running the projector, and I'd be part of like the AV, like in Comtech, you know, putting together the videos and recording all the stuff. And it just kind of led from A to B to C.
What did you think you were going to do when you were that age?
I always knew from an early age I wanted to be in music somehow.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, okay. I got my first keyboard when I was maybe 6.
Oh, wow.
So I even started out electronic.
Is that because your dad was in radio, or like where did that music part of it come in?
I don't know.
Can you remember like a moment when like you heard some music, or like you were exposed to some kind of music, and you were like, what is that?
How yeah, does it work? Two specifics actually, and one of them is totally cliche. Hearing E.T.
Yeah.
And Star Wars were...
Hearing or seeing at the same time?
Hearing it.
Okay.
Because my dad would bring home records.
Right.
So early records, you know, sometimes I'd just lay on the floor listening to records. Like, I knew how to do it when I was like 7.
Yeah.
So I'd have these soundtrack records. I really got into like Sgt. Pepper's, Dark Side of the Moon, and all this stuff when I was like 6 or 7.
Wow.
Which is kind of funny, because that's the stuff you usually hear in your teens, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just hearing all that production and being like, what is this? How is this? You know?
Yeah.
And also, I've been into video games since back then as well. And it was... listening to the old Super Mario stuff, Koji Kondo, and hearing how these things could be a 20-second piece and loop 1,000 times. You'd never get sick of it.
Yeah.
And I just found that fascinating.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to achieve that.
and I was watching that. I think it was like a whole documentary on YouTube on like video game music and like the early, early days, and how they'd literally have to like, it was like, they weren't using keyboards. They weren't using any kind of musical input device. They were literally going, okay, I wrote this piece. Here's what it looks like. And now I have to like select this and put this.
Yeah.
It's almost like punch cards.
I'm guessing it was the Red Bull Digging Through the Carts.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Great, great doc.
Yeah.
You know, they'd have to write the music as you would.
Yeah.
And then they'd have to turn it into assembly language. It just seemed like a terribly hard time.
Like so much back then. I think about that. Like, I mean, I think obviously I would have figured out a way to do it. But it's not like it with computers, with DAWs and with sequencers and all that kind of stuff, and all the electronic wizardly kind of stuff that you have to get used to with music production. I was like drawn to it. Like I wanted to figure it out, touch it, play with it, mess with it, make a sound. But like I think about things like clickbooks or like trying to figure out timings and then writing things on like that stuff. I'm just like, ugh, no. Like I don't know how I would have made it like in the 60s.
And actually, you know, thinking about the clicks, one of the earliest books I ever saw was On the Track,
mm-hmm.
right? Because every composer I talked to would have that on their shelf.
Yeah.
And
there
swear,
it is down
yeah,
your
no,
shelf
I have it now. Yeah. And the last half, maybe the last quarter of the book is this click track translations.
Yeah.
And I'm like, glad I missed that.
Oh man.
This just seems terrible.
Yeah.
But now we just have our own version of terrible, right?
You know? Yeah, I guess it's sort of shifted to something else. That's really funny. Did you have a sense of like this is something that's weird for me to think back on. I never had a sense of the man behind the curtain kind of idea, right?
Right. Like yeah, how is that done?
It's like, just what's like, it just exists. Like I understood that musicians made things. I didn't know what a producer was. I didn't know what a producer did. I don't think I really thought about movie music and imagining the person writing the score. Like my touchstone from those days is Silvestri's Back to the Future.
Yeah. Actually, I forgot to mention that one. That was a big one.
Yeah.
Hence the flux capacitor.
Yeah. So like that idea of like someone making these things and that being a job.
Yeah. The first real eye opener for me where I was like, oh, this is interesting. And it kind of aligned with everything I like about this too.
Yeah.
I remember there was this issue of Keyboard Magazine back in 99 or 98. It was right as The Lion King had finished. Mm. And they did this profile on Hans Zimmer and a few other Hollywood composers. And it kind of gave them a huge spread on here's what their studio is, here's how they're doing their work. And, you know, it's funny looking at those original pictures that kind of took my breath away. Like, wow, that just looks so awesome.
Yeah.
That was the spark where I was like, that looks cool. I want to be involved in that.
That's awesome.
And this is right as I just applied to music engineering college.
Okay.
And I thought I was going to make albums and stuff like that.
Okay, right.
So.
Where did you apply?
Fanshawe College.
And that's where you ended up actually studying, right?
Yep.
Okay.
So I went and trained doing albums on, you know, multi-track tape. It's the first year they had a Pro Tools system.
Yep.
But it was all large format, outboard gear, you know, traditional album making.
Mm.
It wasn't until after I left there where I sort of dove into this whole thing.
Right. So no music training really, apart from probably like piano lessons and stuff like that.
Traditional piano lessons. Yeah. I didn't go through conservatory though. Right. It was just private.
Okay.
Which my conservatory friends say I have terrible fingering. They're like,
what an insult.
They're like, goodness. What are you doing? And I'm like, you know what? I don't know, but I know what I need. I know what I need it to be.
Right.
And that's all the client cares about.
That's right.
You know, they're not like, oh, I see you didn't do your grade 12.
That's right. Like, yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah. I could tell the thumb didn't go under on that one. Oh man. So, so you get at a Fanshawe, you have this idea, well, you think you're going to do this one thing. And then what happens after that?
It's sort of that traditional story where it's like, move to the big city. So moved to Toronto, with my girlfriend at the time where we met in the same program.
Right.
And we're like, we're going to make it in the music business in Toronto. And we get here. Even then rent was expensive. And, she got a job at a coffee shop and I got a job at a gas station. Like it was just like where there was no internet to find things.
Right.
There was no real directory. You know, I didn't know the guild existed, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, so for the first month I worked at a gas station, like unpaid training. And it's one of the few times I've ever quit a job in my life. And it was basically when the guy said, oh yeah, I've only been held up at gunpoint once. And I just said, bye. And I just left.
Just don't bother with the rest of my pay. I don't care.
And then it was just that classic, you know, sometimes things align. And in this situation, it did. And it turned out one of my profs was like, hey, there's a studio that's looking for assistant engineers. You should probably apply there. It's a post place. I'm like,
nice.
Cool. I'll do that. And I went there. I remember the studio owner was just gnawing on a big sandwich. He's like, oh, okay, you went to Fanshawe? Okay, you can start tomorrow.
Wow.
I'm like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing. Great. And then I found out quickly what I was doing.
What studio was that?
It's a studio called Deschamps.
Okay.
And at that point, pretty big post facility. They had five different rooms and one of the first surround mixed theaters in the city. Huge machine room in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Where it was, I was sort of there. And it was back in the old days of analog where there was a SAG strike or something in the States. All the commercials were being shot in Toronto, all on film. So the film would go to the lab. We'd get the stuff at dumped to Beta, I think it was. I'd get it about 11 p.m. I'd take all the Niagara or timecode DATs, synchronize it in a DAW, and then output it to like a master so they could watch all their screeners in the morning.
Wow.
It was brutal, man.
Yeah, it sounds like a grind.
I think I worked on like over 200 commercials in 6 months.
Wow.
And my shift was usually 11 p.m. to 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
How long did you do that for?
8 months.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm out. I can't do this anymore. I'm not seeing anybody. I'm bleeding out the eyes, exhausted.
Wow.
For and I that, felt, right, yeah.
For that.
And actually, the best part was, and I don't know if I can really say this, but I remember having a meeting. I was like, you know what? I think I'm worth more than 24 grand a year. And then there was just this silence on the other end from management. And I was just like, you know, okay, that's it for me. I'm out.
Oh, you weren't like, oh, they're probably just calculating my raise.
No. I think there was this like long gap from what I can recall. I mean, it was a long time ago now, like 22 years ago or whatever. But I just remember there was this pause and I was like, huh. Well, I think this is the end of this, you know. But I learned a lot, like, especially dialogue sync. I can spot it off a mile away. Like,
A curse now.
It is a curse. the biggest curse I had with that job, I was working on this IKEA commercial, and the entire shoot was this couple making out.
Oh, God.
And they were tail slating it. So inevitably, the film would run out, and I wouldn't have a slate to synchronize all this.
Oh.
And I spent the entire day just trying to make sense of this. And I think at that point, God. I was like, I don't ever want to be a dialogue editor.
No kidding.
Yeah, like that's it for me. That was, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just a side story.
Man.
But
that's brutal.
But that actually led to, you know, it's funny how things happen. It turned out after I left, I was kind of scrambling again. I had some savings and, you know, Toronto never rests, right? The rent has to keep being paid. And feels like a moment out of Spaceballs where my dad was like, you know, it turns out my accountant's friend's brother's roommate has a contact at the Nelvana Music Department. And I'm like, that's awesome. Who's that? And then I look it up the best I could at the time. And I was like, oh, they did Care Bears and like Droids and all these things I used to watch. Okay. So, you know, that sort of got me in there. And I'd just call them every week. I'd be like, hey,
right?
Do you have any work for me? Like, is there anything I could do? What can I do? Let me help. You know, trying not to be annoying. And about 6 months later, they said, yeah, we actually have a position, a junior music editor. And
you were like, what's that?
Exactly. I was like, I don't know what that is. Let's do it. And this is where everything came into place, wow. Where we were working on 10 different cartoons at the same time.
Oh my God.
10 different composers.
Yeah.
But I'd get all their cues. I didn't know they were called cues until I worked there. See how it all fit together, how yeah. things would just Lego in and out of each other, like these really cool puzzles. And that's when I realized, like, I want to be making that stuff.
Nice.
Like, this is cool. The music's different on every show. It's not always rock. It's not always orchestral. It could be a hybrid of everything. And that's when I was like, okay, I want to produce stuff like that.
Right.
So that was sort of how it all started.
Is there something, I remember something about a pallet of coffee being delivered to somebody to try and convince them to hire you.
Yeah. So it wasn't a pallet. I wouldn't have been able to afford that. I sent them a huge, well, at the time it was expensive for me. I think it was $40 of Starbucks coffee.
Okay.
And I was like, well, studio people love coffee. What if I just send them a big bag of it?
Nice.
So I sent it to the music department.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a few weeks after that. And actually, I recall putting a note on it, like one of those ransom notes with cut-up letters. I actually was like, please hire me. Hire me, man. So I did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like so ridiculous now. But yeah, that's how, I guess they're like, okay, I guess this guy's serious.
That's great.
I guess we should hire him.
That's charming and creepy with the ransom note. I love it.
Well, aren't all audio people creepy?
I'm going to recuse myself from answering that question.
I plead the fifth.
Lest I incriminate myself. So yeah, and then that sort of, I guess from there, well, are we missing Long and McQuaid? Where does music, working at the music store, fit into all this? I guess you're kind of doing that simultaneously.
No, okay. No, this was after. Yeah, after. So if anybody's listening, I've had a non-linear career path so far. All the beginnings of it was about survival, right? Just paying rent, and I guess it's still the same, right? But
yeah.
So I was working at Nelvana. I was like, this is awesome. I'm working on all these different cartoons. I'm like meeting these composers, and like some of them even wrote the music for shows I used to watch as I was a kid. So I was like, cool. This is cool.
Wow.
And then there was a corporate takeover a year later when Corus bought them, and half the company was sort of pink slipped, including me.
Right.
So that's how I was sort of let loose from there.
Did that feel like the dream is dead? Like,
yeah.
That was and, so close.
And literally I was in a panic. I was like, my rent's crazy and I got to keep going. So another friend of mine from college was working at a music store. He's like, hey, I just got a job at Yamaha. Do you want my job? I'm like, yeah, please. So I ended up working at a music store. I didn't really like it, but I was one of their only experienced post-production people.
Right.
So inevitably when someone would come in and be like, I need help with setting up a Pro Tools system, or do you know anybody who can do like synth programming or fix this problem? I'd be like, I'll do it. And I'd just hire myself out for cash after work. And eventually over time that got busier than the actual job.
Okay.
So then I went from full-time to sort of loose part-time, and then from part-time to sometime, and then to no time.
Yeah.
Over the span of, it's like 5 or 6 years, I think.
Right.
But actually we were talking about this earlier. So that's when, you know, I'm working at the music store. I'd see these specific types of people come in. that just looked like zombies. They were exhausted. they almost couldn't even speak sentences. They'd be like, hey, do you know anybody who can, you know, and it'd be like Pro Tools or the synth programming or fix a problem or the computer's not working. And
yeah.
Then I realized these are actually film and television composers in Toronto.
Yeah.
And they just needed help. They're just exhausted. And I had no idea what that, like, why would they be tired? They're just writing music. This is cool. Like, little did I know. And then sure enough, on my first series, I was the exact same person. My friends working, they were like, yeah, dude, you'd come in, you'd be like there, but not. And I'd be like, yeah, I was just tired. And then it was like,
yeah.
So that's how I met a lot of the composers in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, they start trusting you with things and they're like, hey, can you help me with this? Oh, you used to be a music editor here. Do you want a music edit for us?
Right.
You know, so it sort of pulled me out of what I didn't want into what I wanted.
Right. Yeah. 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 That was always, when I first got to know you, I thought that was such an interesting sort of story, like your story of how you sort of got and did what you were doing, because you found a way to do something that almost nobody else had the right combination of skills to do and the right temperament to do. And you managed to sort of leverage that into other opportunities, you know, whether that was conscious or not, I don't know. But like, and also just to, as you say, like to be befriending these people, to get to know them, to see the work that they do, probably like a lot of informal mentorships probably came out of that too, where you're learning stuff from them and just being a fly on the wall getting to see how the sausage is made, for lack of a better phrase.
Pure mayhem is how it's made. Pure mayhem. No, I'm just kidding. I never thought that would have been the catalyst moment where I start meeting all these people and it starts shifting gears.
Yeah.
But so that started happening. And then while that was all happening and I was slowly phasing myself out from Long McQuaid Music, I got a call from Nelvana because one of the people there who wasn't let go worked their way up the ranks.
Oh, wow.
And they were at the helm of the music department. And
it
was maybe 4 years later, they're like, hey, I remember you said you wanted to get into cartoon music composing. Do you want to try pitching on some stuff?
Wow.
And the first thing I pitched on was the logo for their company.
Oh, wow.
And I got it.
Wow.
So that was the end. Like, that was the start.
That's so cool.
And I totally undercharged for that, but that's fine because it led to a lot of other things.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Looking back on that,
it's a loss leader.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, it was definitely the loss leader in my career. But, you know, we were talking about this earlier. It's all about tiers of trust, you know, that they'll trust you with this thing and they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing. Well, maybe we'll try this.
Yeah.
So I did a few shorts for them. And then eventually happened where they're like, hey, we have this anime repackage and we need the score redone. You know, the budget isn't great, but do you want to give it a shot? They kind of want it to be a mix of electronics and orchestra. And these are two things I love a lot. And I could meld them together. And they gave good references like Stereolab and the Life Aquatic, Steve Zissou, the Ping Island action scene where it's ridiculous flute and orchestra.
Yeah.
And they're like, we want to kind of sound like that.
Awesome.
And I was like, okay. So that was actually the first series, like full-fledged series I ever did.
Wow.
It didn't go anywhere, but I didn't let them down.
Mm-hmm.
And we even had a producer change halfway through where they're like, what's all the synthesizers? I don't like synthesizers, you know? So I navigated that and I never gave them any issue. So that's sort of when I finally was sort of on the list, so to speak, for not every show going out, but you know, for shows that suit my vibes, which is like synthesizers and orchestra and Hollywood vibes. And and that's sort of what springboarded the whole thing. So
that really beautifully illustrates that saying that you should always be solving more problems than you're causing. And it sounds so 101 when you say it. Like, a lot of axioms kind of sound like, well, no kidding. But it's funny how oftentimes that seems to be actually a rare thing. Like, when I get thanked for things, it's like, you solve problems and you didn't create any. I'm like, well, yeah, why would I? What kind of crazy person does? But I guess it happens more often than not.
Yeah, and I mean, this is way later in time now, and I've worked with them on a ton of shows since, and they know I'm someone they never have to double check on.
Right.
Once we have the sound of a show, the palette, so to speak, they just let me loose, and I'm just one-on-one with the director. Like, I usually just check in with the music department when I'm sending an invoice. Like, they don't have to worry. And I think that's what they love.
That's
because
amazing.
I'm not going to let them down. I don't. It's not what I do. So
That's not part of your brand.
No.
Letting people down.
Yeah. For this price, I can let you down. And for this price.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Tiered pricing where I mean, like, it's going to be garbage files. You're not going to know what's going on. I'm going to miss deadlines.
Yeah. First, I'm going to label every queue with the same time code number. And second, it will be in mono. And third, it'll be at 8K.
Audio 001. Audio 001 yeah. copy.
Yeah.
Audio
yeah.
001 copy two.
Final mix three, final mix 10. But you'd be surprised. Like, I mean, I've been sort of all over the place career-wise working on this, and I've been working as a music editor on other things. And there is a lot of that happens.
Sure.
There's so much stuff out there that isn't organized.
Right.
And it kind of boggles my mind that a lot of stuff gets finished.
Yeah.
Without people going crazy.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure it has to do with, like, your... I just want to know your sort of take on this, actually. Like, is it a combination of temperament? Like, how you deliver? Like, let's say even those early days, like, why do you think that that person that was in Nelvana that worked their way up remembered you specifically? Because you weren't, like, one of the long-term veteran hotshots
right.
At Nelvana. Like, how did that, what do you think was it about? Because that's such a great story. It's like you think it's all over, and then... this person that happens to be, because I think that's the whole key to everything, is like you just try to leave a good impression with people, and as they move hopefully in a, you know, upward trajectory through their own career, you might get a call
yeah,
at some
yeah.
point and go, hey, I'm working on this thing now, why do you want to come along?
I pride myself on being easy to work with
yeah.
while maintaining professionalism,
right?
Because it's not always slanted that way. Someone can be really easy to work with and then they just make a mess of everything, so
sure.
it's kind of a pointless thing, right?
Yeah.
But the way we're talking now is the way I deal with any client, actually. Like, I'm never uptight or angry. Like, I'm pretty even keel.
Mm.
And I think that puts a lot of people at ease.
Yeah.
And you're having fun doing serious work.
Yeah.
And I think that was a lot of it. And, you know, we'd hang out at lunchtime sometimes. And
how do you deal with stress? Like, when things are really... Because that is true. You are... And I think I'm the same way. Is that, like... You get on a call with someone and like things are not going well. Okay, we need to make these changes. This is the client, like the executive producers come back to us and actually the direction that we've gone in is not, I know I told you to go this direction, but we're not going this direction anymore. We need to scrap everything and start over again. You're like, okay, that's not fun. How do you deal with that and still maintain that professional, upbeat, positive attitude?
Under my breath, I'm like, God damn fuck. Good question. I don't get flustered with stress because I just plan ahead knowing that there will be stress at some point.
Okay, right.
So I just know something will happen at yeah, some point.
Yeah.
So why get bent out about it?
Do you, okay, so then.
Or do you mean like, how do I self-manage personally?
Oh, sure. Well, whatever you want to answer that. I think that is a good answer, right? Like this idea is like you plan for the worst. Or you plan, you build in some, even if it's a psychological buffer to say, you know, at some point, something's going to go off the end of the table.
That's exactly how I think. I'm right. like, you know, if I'm, you know, 4 months into a show
yeah.
and something bananas hasn't happened yet, I'm like, this is odd. Okay, it'll just happen at some point soon.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
There are times where, you know, things kind of go haywire and it's a legit time crunch that isn't achievable.
Okay.
And on those few times, it hasn't happened a lot, but those are the few times I've actually just flat out said no.
Okay.
I'm like, what you're asking me is absolutely unreasonable. I'm not a robot.
Yes.
You know, it's Friday at 6 p.m. I can't accommodate this for this date you're giving me.
Right.
It's not happening.
Yeah.
So.
And what's the response been when you've done that?
There's the initial shock, like, oh, how could you, you know, fight up against us?
Or, yes.
But once they sit back and realize, oh, you know what? Maybe mixing these 60 cues by Tuesday morning is a little bit unreasonable while rewriting half of them and whatever.
Right.
And they're like, oh, maybe we should just reassess our notes. And then inevitably, half of them go away.
I wonder, too, if it's like they... Okay, so if it was somebody else, they might go, get your shit together and get it done. Whereas, like, they know you deliver and you do so much and you're so capable that if you're saying it's not possible...
And I did bring that up one time. I was like, look... You know, I'm one of your fastest people to do this kind of problem
right.
solving.
Like, yeah.
And I'm telling you
yeah.
that A, this is unreasonable. B, I'm not going to get sick over this show.
Mm-hmm.
I care, but I don't care that much.
Yeah.
You could fire me if you want.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, and I think also it just has to do with the modern way we work. People forget that when you're sending an email to somebody, there is somebody on the other side of it.
Yeah.
So you're not, it's just not a robot. And then all of a sudden something arrives when they're like, oh yeah, you know what? Maybe there needs to be sleep. Maybe there needs to be,
right.
There needs to be time.
Yeah.
Once they sort of sit back and kind of reflect on that, they're like, oh, okay.
I think a good perspective for everyone that's, you know, I actually think for anyone, even if you've been in the business for a while, is to remember that probably the people who are asking you to do incredibly ridiculous things are probably having been asked to do them themselves as well, are so busy that they're just like, I need to solve this problem. The way that I do that is by sending you an email that says, do this.
Yeah.
Done. Okay. Next fire to pull
next,
out.
Which department?
And they're not even like, and then when you fire back and you're like, oh, okay, maybe I need to think about this a little bit more. It's not like, I don't care about Neil and screw him and this is going to be completely unreasonable. It's like, I have too much other things. I'm just assuming that Neil can do it. Let's get it done. And that's it.
Yeah. Now, there are times where I know it's going to be bananas.
Right.
And I will plan those. I'm like, okay,
yeah.
I legit actually have to get all this stuff done. So I have to make sure I have no outside plans. There's no family stuff. My phone is off. Mm. I am unavailable until I come back up for air.
Yeah.
So I think I'm pretty sure you're in this kind of boat too, where friends and family kind of know when you go dark that you're in the thick of it, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't always avoid those situations.
Sure.
But the ones that are absolutely unreasonable,
yeah,
I think I'm old and grumpy enough to say no. But I don't think, you know, someone just getting into it should fear saying no either if it's absolutely unreasonable.
Yeah.
Like, you should never get sick over a job, you know?
Yeah.
And that's happened probably one too many times for me. And now I just have a hard pass. I'm like, nope.
Yeah.
I'll just... you fire me, I guess you fire me.
Yeah.
I mean, I never frame it like that to them, but
yeah,
but I think they get it. You
well,
know?
It's also the 11th hour. They're asking you to do this crazy thing because it's like they have no other choice. Well, who else is going to do this?
Who else can we throw under the bus? Who else could it be? Oh, Neil could do it.
how do you feel about like, okay, so you're early in a project, you're doing something. Do you have situations where you're presenting something? Like, you've got an idea, you've put it together, and it's a little on the outside, like you're taking a bit of a swing. Do you get nervous about that? You're like sending stuff in there. You're like, this is a little outside.
Well, I mean, I'll be nervous internally, but I'll never let them know.
Okay.
Because the worst thing is, it's like, guys, I did this amazing cue for you guys. You're going to love it.
Right.
And then of course, that's one when during playback, they're like, and you've sort of self-sabotaged yourself. But if you just, I'll always give them two options if I do something like that. And I'll always have the riskier one first.
Right.
And just see what happens.
Okay.
Because.
So you don't preface anything.
Nope. I'm just like here we go.
Interesting.
And actually, kind of on a side note, that's how I am with pitches now.
Mm.
You know, when we get these pitch briefs for animation, they're very specific.
Mm.
And my thought is, if they're going to get 10 submissions all sounding the same, then how are they going to pick one?
You know?
I realized probably late in the game that when I'm pitching on something, this is my time.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do what I think it should
be. Yeah.
I mean, I'll go within what they're asking for if it's really hyper specific, but I'll still add my stamp to it and go outside the box of the brief a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'll just take that chance because most of the animation pitches are unpaid and it's my time. I'm just going to do what I want. And if I don't get it, I don't get it.
I like that idea of not overselling something, like this idea of not getting too excited. Like, oh my God, guys, listen to what I did. This is, I'm so excited. But also managing that internal kind of thing where you're like, it may get thrown out.
Yeah.
You know?
And there, I can't even talk. Wow. Listen to me go. If only I could quantize this. Yeah, what's the word? Is it playing? It's not being coy. It's just kind of being
reserved.
Yeah. They're like, how'd it go? I'll be like, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, yeah, I think you'll like, this is a great episode.
I'll
just reframe it, you know?
Yeah, it's managing the ups and downs of it too for yourself. Because emotionally, if you go like so high for yourself, and you're like, oh my God, they're going to love this. And then they're like, I don't know.
But you know what? I think that's just composing in general. Rejection is just part of the job. So even if they don't like something, I'm not thrown by it.
Yeah.
And more often than not, the directors I work with will be like, I totally see what you're going for. That cue's great.
Yeah.
Let's save it for the library and use it somewhere
else.
Sure. Nothing is truly tossed in the garbage.
Because
I think if that happened, I wouldn't have a job, right?
You probably even want to reframe the idea of rejection because it's not rejection. It's not like they're saying you suck. They're saying, this doesn't work within the framework of what we imagine for this particular thing.
And I ran into that a lot working with Japan.
Okay.
Because it's, if we think of all the parameters of what a cue conveys emotionally.
Yeah.
I could think happy means X. Right. Whereas for them, happy means Y. You know? So it's not that you're doing a bad job. You're just not. Things just aren't aligning.
Right.
So it's just figuring out those pathways. And then once, and you know how it is, like once you figure out your director, initially you'd write something and be like, oh yeah, this is hitting that emotion. But I know they like this kind of vibe based on the movies they told me they like and blah, blah, blah. So you kind of tweak it.
Yeah.
But that was a constant struggle with doing the animes, because when I think of heartfelt, I might sort of slant on the more Hollywood way of doing it.
Okay.
And for them, it was more 2 a.m. lounge piano.
Okay, right.
So I'm like, oh, I could totally get that, but I didn't think that. I never would have known. So yeah. Like initially working on those animes, cues are being thrown out left and right. And I was in a panic. I was thinking, they're going to fire me for sure.
Right.
But they just kept saying, oh, no, we're super happy. But we just got to figure out these things. And as soon as I figured out that A means X and B means D and whatever,
yeah.
As soon as I got that, I think I only had 2 cues rejected for the rest of the entire show.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit on that, because this is going into like Bakugan, right? And Beyblade?
This is Beyblade.
Beyblade, right. So how did that end up happening? Because now you're working with, you're working on anime with, because the first one you said you did with a North American company, and it was all, you know, basically local. And then now you're working with Japanese producers?
Yeah.
There's a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier. And everything is so, like, walk me through how you get to that point and what that sort of journey was like.
Oh, so Nelvana does a lot of repackaging of shows from other countries, and they got into the anime market with actually, I think Beyblade was one of their first ones.
Mm.
This was like a reboot of it.
Okay,
they're basically reversioning it for here. And usually, when that happens, dialogue and music are tossed out from the Japanese side and redone here.
Okay.
And this was the first time where the clients overseas were saying, no, we still want control of the music, but I guess based on tax credits and production and all that stuff, it all had to be done here. I didn't know the full story.
Yeah.
They're just like, the composer has to be here because this is where all the post is being done. Yeah. This is where everything's being done.
Yeah.
But we're not overseeing you at all. The Japanese side is going to...
Okay.
Deal with everything. So it was really hilarious because I had a translator assigned to me for this show. We're also dealing with time zone shifts here, you know, 13 hour differences. Right. So they're like, this is due at Monday, you know, 9 a.m., which is Sunday at 6 p.m. for me. And the lines of communication would always take a few days.
Right.
Like I'd never have instant answers to everything. Mm. So, you know, I'd be writing 5 to 7 minutes a day while like mixing the other stuff and stemming it. And sometimes I'd need an answer and I just wouldn't get them.
It
was a really complicated gig and actually still one of the hardest gigs I've ever had. But initially I was worried because the emails were kind of cryptic here and there. Figuring that out, getting this stuff sorted so I wasn't in a panic took like a month.
Oh my God.
It was a long time.
So like, what was that? Was that just by experience, trial by fire, this didn't work, I learned it was this, and then going, like, you're almost like trying to figure out like the alphabet of a different language, like A equals X, as you're saying. Or was it that you were said, okay, let me do some research and figure out like how these things actually work by watching some of the shows?
There honestly wasn't time.
Okay.
Literally trial by fire.
Wow.
Getting stuff rejected, being upset about it initially and being let's try this. And then sometimes you just get these curveballs. You're like, okay, everything's going great now. This is smooth. And then you'd get like weird descriptions for a cue. Like, this has to sound like he's a really cool guy. Make sure you use piano and recorder. and I'm not even like, I'm not even kidding. Like, that's a real one. Or be like, this one has to sound like the sound of a heart bursting through a dragon or something.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be like, what? And then there was another one where they were like, yeah, they're hanging out and, hanging out as a gang and they're just having fun. They'd always have a music image, which would be their musical reference.
Yeah.
And it was Ride of the Valkyries.
Okay.
Like, dun, 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 dun. And I was like, above that cue, there was an action cue. Okay. So I emailed right away. I was like, is that just on the wrong column? And they're like, no, that's for the right cue. So I'm like, wait, they're hanging out, just chilling out, having a good time. And it's like, dun, 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 dun. So I had to like write cues that made no sense in my brain. They're like, yes, that's it. I'm like, okay, all right.
So, okay. So to go back to the video game stuff, like now I'm wondering, like, they made those, like, all these classic video games written by Japanese composers, made developed by Japanese developers. I mean, North American audiences had no problem interpreting what they were going for there. Like, it's...
Well, that's the trickiest thing. So when I was working on Bakugan, I was writing in the style of North America. Since electric guitar, monster truck, battle, you know. And then on the Beyblade one, because it was for Japanese market, they're like, no synths, has to be organic, orchestra only, sometimes guitar.
Mm.
So I was literally writing the stuff that we usually throw out. Not because it's bad, it's just different target markets,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I was writing the music that we usually throw out. And then interestingly, North America liked it. And I still get emails to this day like, oh man, that was the soundtrack of my childhood.
Oh wow.
Like, that's so cool. Can you release the masters? I'm like, no.
That is an interesting thing about anime. It's like, I find that generally as a viewer very fascinating, just to sort of watch, like, what emotions are they trying to evoke? And then sometimes they'll say a phrase and it's kind of like, oh yeah, they mean to give me this feeling. Like, I don't get that from that phrase, but I think this is what they're aiming for.
It's all about the eyeballs. If there's an exclamation mark on it,
right,
it's serious.
Okay.
Or if there's like a shake,
yeah,
freeze frame, yeah, you know? Yeah, you know what? It's still one of the hardest shows I've ever had.
Wow.
And mainly because everything just felt like a question mark to me the whole time.
Right.
And actually, I don't know if I ever told you this, but after the first season, they wanted to change music direction.
Okay.
So they hired somebody else.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, okay. Well, my contract's done, so I didn't get fired, but okay. So in a weird twist, I went to Japan for vacation, and then a week into it, I get a call from Chorus and they're like, can you make this meeting? It's not working out. They want you back. And I'm like, I can come to this meeting, but just keep in mind, I have no work clothes. I'm in Japan, so I can't buy work clothes that will fit me.
Right.
I look like a disheveled traveler. Is this going to be a problem? And they're like, yeah, just go, just go, just go.
No.
So
I'm going to guess that everyone shows up with a suit.
Oh, okay. It's even worse.
Oh no.
So I took the wrong train, and I was an hour late.
Oh, no.
Which is like, that's not something that's supposed to happen, but what am I supposed to do? Like,
yeah.
They have different tiers of trains. There's like an express train, a semi-express, rapid commute, and I took the one that missed like 10 of the stops.
Right. Okay.
Because I was like, oh, this one's coming earlier. I'll just jump on that one. Mm-hmm. And of course.
No.
So anyway, I get there, and they're very gracious for me showing up, even though I'm like really late. So they're probably just like, who the hell is this?
Yeah.
And, you know, I look the way I look right now, just kind of disheveled. And they walk me in and it's this massive boardroom table. And on one side, it's all the executives. And the director was in the middle because he was wearing the cool hat and cool glasses. I was like, okay.
That's allowed.
Yeah. And then me on the other side with my translator and just a cup of tea.
Wow.
And I was just freaking out internally.
Oh my God.
Like, I remember touching that desk and seeing my sweat dissipating. Yeah. And that meeting went on for, I think it was about 2 hours. And I walked out of there with a job for the next season. So.
did you think you had a job at the end of the meeting?
No. I got a call from Canada and they're like, yeah, you got it. And I'm like, what? Okay.
That's crazy.
So, and then in a weird twist, I had to fly home early from Japan to write music for Japan. Like, it was like the weirdest thing. But those shows really sort of springboarded the career. They did very well. We were really surprised at how well those shows did.
Right, right. And it must have just sort of like, that's a badge of honor just to get through that stuff and to be able to say, yeah, I just did this.
Yeah.
We got it in the can.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights of film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. And now, back to our show.
And did that sort of start your interest and love of Japan? Because you go back sort of for vacation pretty often.
Yeah, that's exactly what springboarded that whole thing. Just going there, culturally, I love it because there's no 50% It's either all or nothing.
Right.
And I now that I think back on it and reflect on that show, I think musically that's what it was too.
Okay, right.
You know, when they meant the sound of a dragging bursting through somebody's heart,
yeah,
it's on.
Yeah.
There's no 50% there. Like, yeah, this is happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now I totally get it when I watch older animes where the music is just almost in your face, aggressively over the top.
Yeah.
Even if it's like a light and playful thing versus the action music. After having written that stuff, it all makes sense. It's like, it's all or nothing. Whereas here we have, there's degrees of intensity. Yeah. There it's like everything. 100%. It's amazing as a country seeing it because it could be the most beautiful temple you've ever seen,
mm-hmm,
or 15-foot robots battling each other, which is equally amazing. Like, there's no in between.
There's no in between.
And I love that.
It's a bit contrasting. I know Marty Friedman, the ex-guitar player from Megadeth, talked about that. He actually moved to Japan. So one of the things he loved about it was that there wasn't this kind of like siloing of genres and likes, dislikes. When Kiss first toured in Japan, everyone was like, oh yeah, we get it. This isn't scary. It's kabuki theater. Like, oh, of course. And then he said, like, you know, you can go to a concert and it's like basically a metal band and they'll play the most brutal power metal you can possibly imagine.
But amazingly.
And technically absolutely perfect and correct. And looks scary as hell, makeup, demon imagery, like crazy lights, fire, blah, blah, blah. And then the song finishes, the band goes away, they pull out a big sparkly piano, and the lead singer sits down and plays the most sappy, like, saccharine ballad you could ever
imagine.
And they love it. And it's like absolutely seamless between those two transitions. Like, yes, that's what's going to happen here.
And my one takeaway from going there, well, I have tons of them, but one thing that surprised me was just how into music they are culturally. Like, the biggest music stores I've ever seen were all in Japan.
Yeah.
Their Tower Records was like the size of like 5 Walmart supercenters stacked on top of each other.
Hmm.
You know, there was like an entire floor dedicated to jazz, another one for movie soundtracks and games, and another one for like K-pop and J-pop and North American music. And it was just like, wow. And they're all about physical media.
Yeah.
They want the CDs. They want the DVDs, the Blu-rays, all that stuff. It's just such an opposite contrast to here. I think the only place that kind of compared to it here was in LA, like Amoeba Music or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But picture that place
times
1,000.
Right.
You know, and that's...
Toronto to me is intimidating because it feels like... there's a kind of like, everyone's standing at the back of the room with their arms crossed, sort of waiting for you to fail, or like it's very hard to feel like you're concerned about being cool and not being too earnest.
Oh, I know I'm not cool. So it just works. It just works out.
But I feel like in Japan, one of the things that sort of interests me about it as an artist would be like, I feel like if you just did your thing full wholeheartedly, even if it was very theatrical and
very earnest
and very emotional, they'd be like, yeah, that's great. You're doing your thing.
Yeah. I think I learned early on because cartoon music is its own weird little island.
Yeah.
I just realized it was really weird. So I just kind of embraced it. And I was like, well, if you don't like it, you're probably not a 6-year-old kid, you know, sorry.
Like, no doubt.
You know, like, I've come to terms with it. I mean, I write strange, really short pieces of music a lot of the time, and that's not going to please your average movie score aficionado or something. You know, it's just, it's a totally different thing, and I'm fine with that.
Well, we'll get back to that. You mentioned LA, and I sort of want to, like, because you have this really interesting, as you say, parallel career, and one of the things you do is you play a lot of different very important and vital roles to Andrew Lockington.
Yep.
And that's taken you to Los Angeles, Fox, Sony, Abbey Road, Air, like tons of the best, most premier places, playing, like, recording with the greatest musicians on the planet and working on some of the biggest, you know, massive films like Rampage, San Andreas, Journey. It's just sort of like you're sort of in this really interesting position where you're providing high level technical services. And I'd sort of like be interested to hear a bit about that. Like, what is it that Andrew goes to you for? Cause it's a number of different things, including what I read in your IMDb Pro Tools Guru, which is my favorite credit. And then, like, what's your experience in Los Angeles and that whole scene? Cause like Andrew obviously, you know, occupies a very, vaunted kind of, you know, position. What's your experience been with that?
How do I unwrap that one? Shit. Sorry. beep beep.
I love that's how it's like it's that sound what was it called,
yeah, that little slate thing,
yeah.
I met Andrew totally by accident. I think John Wellsman may have given him my number at a barbecue or a wedding or something like that.
Okay.
And when he called me, he was like, I'm working on this movie called Journey, and I need some sampler systems built to host all these, my virtual orchestra kind of thing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was like, sorry, dude, I'm too busy. That was our first interaction.
Amazing.
I was like, I am so slammed,
yeah,
but I can give you the name of someone who can help you. And in a weird twist of fate, the person I recommended totally dropped the ball.
Oh, no.
And he called me back and he's like, are you sure you're not too busy? Because this is right in the middle of like my anime work. So
right.
I was just like treading water trying
oh
to,
my God.
You know, do all that. So initially I built his sampling systems to host his virtual orchestra.
Yeah.
And it kind of exploded from there because I have a history of a lot of tech work and studio flow and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
So it'd be like, you'd make your life easier if you spent a bit more money and did this,
yeah,
or took this out of your system, or if we did this, et cetera, and figuring out faster ways to achieve certain tasks. Just like what we were talking about before, those tiers of trust, you know,
eventually.
I'd take on more stuff. He's like, hey, do you want to mix this show for me? Or do you want to music edit this for me? So we just keep it all internal.
Right.
I'd be like, yeah, absolutely. And then it was like, do you want to design some synth sounds for me, et cetera. So it's kind of all these things, but the big takeaway from it is my job for him is giving him more time to write.
Okay.
That's it. That's my job.
Right.
I don't make coffee. I don't do any of that.
Yeah.
But tech-wise, my job is to make his life as easy as possible so he has more time to write notes.
Yeah.
So
when you're on a set, okay, so like some of the different, you're like technical assistant to the composer, score mixer, you've written additional music, obviously, as well.
No.
Oh, you haven't done that?
Nope.
Not in his shows. Okay,
nope.
So that's for something else. You've done synth development or whatever, synth sound design, synth programming. Anything else?
Ooh, there's so, yeah.
Lots of other stuff.
So like, it's kind of this umbrella of techery, right?
Techery, I like it.
I mean, but if we were breaking it down into film job kind of tasks,
yeah,
music editing,
yeah,
score mixing, yeah, synth sound design,
okay,
and just general tech, studio tech stuff.
So when you're down, like, let's say he, you fly with him to like, or you fly down to LA or you're going to like air. What are you doing when you're actually on the sessions?
I prepare all the Pro Tool sessions for the record. So all the clicks, prelays, all those things.
Mm.
If my work is done correctly, not too much other than being a second ear in the room.
Okay.
We'll catch bad notes from orchestration and stuff like that. Or if he's focused on something else, I'll be like, hey,
yeah,
you know, I think we need to do this take again. It's pitchy at these measures. It's just catching these things.
Yeah,
And because we've worked together so long, I just know what he's looking for.
Yeah.
And he always says, I can tell when you breathe a certain way that there's a problem with that cue. Because sometimes I don't want to bug him because he's in the middle of thought. But he's like, wait, I hear Neil going, hmm. He'd be like, what is it? I'd be like,
that's great.
It's pitchy at measure 250. He's like, oh, it is. Okay. We'll do another one.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, if everything works out, I'm there for emotional support and any surprises.
Yeah.
I usually hang out for the mixes because inevitably, even though we stem everything out and run it off, we might need to correct a few things, mm-hmm, and I can do that on the fly right there instead of kind of being on a standby in a different time zone, right?
Yeah.
So it makes sense that I'm there. I know those crews very well now. So it's just shorthand being there. The one thing I don't like about it, though, is knowing what my scores could sound like if they had the budgets that these movies have.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I think in a day, we'll burn like an entire season's music budget for a cartoon.
Holy,
you know what I mean? It's just like, oh, I just shoulda, coulda, woulda. But I think we were talking about this before. I sometimes have regrets that I didn't focus 100% on my music side of my career.
Yeah.
But as much as I love that, and I've learned so much, when I hear that orchestra on the floor, I'm like, man, my cartoon's not going to have that. And they sound so good. Like, they're amazing.
I want to come back to what we're talking about now, but just as because you interject with this, I find this a really interesting topic because I struggle with the same thing, like woulda, shouldas. But then I sort of do the thought experiment. I'm like, well, what would you have done different? And is there any guarantee that any other action or any other strategy, quote unquote, would actually have resulted in anything different? Like, when I look at what you do and where you're at, Like, literally, visually, I look around this room and I go, Neil's doing what he should be doing in a lot of ways. Like, you're really well suited. And, like, and also just, like, the experience of, like watching the stuff that you've done and listening to the music you make is, like, I get a lot out of it. Like, I was binging, like, hardcore binging Bravest Warriors. And I'm like, this is just so fun, partly because of how great the music is.
Oh, thanks, Ben.
So, you know, I mean, like, I wonder about that. Like, I understand that impetus to go, oh, if only. But, I mean, like, well, what else would you have done?
And,
like,
and
that's a serious question. Do you have an idea of what you would have done?
Well, and that's the thing, you know. I think we all get in these cycles where we're like, man.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah.
Which is weird because I'm like 20 years into this.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like.
Look around you.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm right at the beginning, but then mm-hmm. I have to sort of be like, no, you idiot.
Yeah.
Like, you're doing good and you're doing what you like to do.
Yeah.
I can't do a go back. So why dwell on it?
Yeah.
This is what it is.
Yeah.
I'm not miserable.
Yeah.
Yet.
Working on it.
I'm working on getting miserable, but I don't know if I'm really answering your question. Yeah, I just have those moments sometimes where I'm like, man, yeah. Like, I wish I had done this, but it's a pointless exercise.
Well, I think too, like, I mean, something that I think I've come to the conclusion to in terms of, like, partly just, you know, life experience and talking to a lot of composers and a lot of people who've been like are super pro at this, like, there are just things that happen to you in your life and certain, like you said, like somehow this just worked out. And then this person called me and this person happened to get this job. Like, you, there's so much of it that's out of your control.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like you can go, I should have gone to LA and talked to this guy and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Okay. You could have done that. That's no guarantee. I know so many people who've gone that tack and went hardcore and burned out and then came back and then they just got embittered and they didn't want to even pursue music anymore. So.
Yeah. I remember early on. Well, actually, even recently too, you know, I've had people be like, you should move to LA. Mm. Like, you do good there. And I'm mm-hmm. like, yeah, but you know what? My friends and my family are here.
Yeah.
Why would I break all the relationships I've made and all these clients I've built up here mm-hmm. over like 20 years just sure. to go somewhere else where it's twice as sharky and
starting over.
Starting from zero. Like, yeah. I don't want to start from zero now. I'm too old. I can't change.
Yeah.
I like LA a lot. But I like it as a visitor. I don't think I could live there.
Yeah.
As much as I love it.
Yeah. So, like, to go back to this idea of, like, as you get more successful, like, is your name in lights? Or, like, are you on these really huge known shows? Or do you have, like, this prestige kind of stuff? Mm. You know, your life inevitably gets more complicated. It gets more stressful. There's more moving parts. And there's more to worry about. And it's, I think if you talk about it in a different way, like, forget success for a second and just talk about, like, happiness, fulfillment, a feeling of purpose. I think we have all of those things. Does doing it that way make it feel like more? Like, would it be nice to hear your work done by the LSO every, like, film that you're on? Yes, that would be amazing.
That would be nice.
But, you know, there's definitely a cost to that. I'm sure Andrew would agree, right? Like, you don't get that for nothing.
No. That stuff is really expensive. Yeah, I'd love to hear an orchestra play my music. It'd be like the best 10 seconds ever.
What are some of the most surprising things you've learned in working with Andrew and doing working at that level, sort of studio grade level movies?
Oh, the crews.
Yeah.
At the scoring stage or Abbey Road or all these places, they're at their top of their game and totally humble. There's no egos, you know, everybody's just doing what they need to do. And it's just this smooth as butter thing most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't think it would be that nice.
Oh yeah.
You know,
pleasant.
Actually, a good example was one of the first movie I worked on with Andrew was City of Ember and Nicholas Dodd is the orchestrator on that.
Yeah. A monster for anyone who doesn't know, like, just insane.
Yeah, he's amazing. I still talk to Nicholas all the time. He's always asking me about motorcycles and my cats and the music I'm working on. Like, he's triple A-list, just genuinely curious to know what I'm working on and how it's all going. And,
oh, that's so cool.
You know, and we'll talk about, like, since. I thought there'd be a huge barrier or something, or a huge river divide.
Sure.
Even working with their engineers. You know, what reverb do you like for this and this situation? And they're like, oh, it's this one. Oh. I was expecting like this huge kickback. I was just surprised at how everybody just genuinely loves what they do, because otherwise they wouldn't be in those positions.
Sure,
and I think I share that same kind of passion for this kind of thing. I'm not just this grumpy old boob. Yeah. Like, oh, post-production. Time code.
I was watching this. Did you see the Arcane series on Netflix?
No.
It's that animated thing. It's very, very well done. And they have this great making of, like a multi-part making of kind of documentary on YouTube. And one of the things they say, or the one of the things that comes out of it, is they're talking to the French animation company who they hired to sort of do this very interesting combination of 3D animation and 2D animation, which creates this very painterly kind of look. And they've got all these effects and diffusions, and it just has this ultra, ultra unique style.
Cool.
And there was some effect or some way they were like, what's the process that you go, like, how do you get this really neat look? And they're like, yeah, that's the secret sauce. And they like the sort of did this jump cut of three different high level guys at this company, and they all said the same thing.
They would
like,
they wouldn't
they were exchange. Like, yeah, yeah, they sort of chuckled and like, yeah, we're not going to tell you what that is.
Yeah,
that's literally our brand value. Mm. And I'm like, do you think something like that exists in film scoring and music? Do you think there's like a secret sauce?
When I was first getting going and talking to some composers here and there, there was definitely that closed gate kind of thing.
Right.
Like, well, how do you do this part quickly? And they're like, no, I can't, talk about that.
Wow.
But I realized that the secret sauce is just the person's brain when they're writing.
Yeah.
But everything else is just tools.
Yeah.
So I think anybody who's been in this long enough will just share how they use the tools. Like, why not? Like, you're not giving away your secret sauce of your brain when you're writing.
Yeah.
Like, these are just, oh, you use that Mac with this thing and that audio interface with that plugin? Great. Like, why is that a secret?
Yeah.
You know, like everybody has that. Like, everybody has access to the same stuff.
That's it. Right.
So I've always, even when younger composers approach me now and they're like, how do you get that sound? Or like, what was that drum thing you did? Or I'm just like, here it is. You won't sound like me because I'm me and you're you, but here's how I did it. Like, why would I hide that? I don't care.
Interesting.
But I found that with, these engineers and stuff too, like they'll gladly share a technique or, an orchestration technique or whatever, because at the end of the day, they're still doing their thing and I'm still doing my thing.
Yeah. They've already gotten to the plate. It's not like they're competing against you.
Yeah.
You're not suddenly going to come and like take their job away from them.
Yeah. They have nothing to prove. I have nothing to prove.
Yeah.
And even if I share a process to a colleague in Toronto, they're not going to like steal a job out from under me. I'd hope.
Yeah.
And if they did, I'd find them. And I'd press my remote kill switch on their computer. Yes. No, but
use a Janet Jackson bass line to destroy their computer systems.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's important for information sharing at the end of the day.
Right.
There was a time where a lot of stuff was hidden. And I think now with everybody having access to everything, it just helps everybody having the knowledge.
They'll find it somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably YouTubers right now that are like music YouTubers that write better, cooler sounding music than both of us, right, combined. They just don't happen to have a job, and they're sharing all that information with everybody on the
exactly
world.
And I, as I told you earlier, I'm not cool at all, so in a sense I've won because I don't have to try.
So to go back to as I was saying, I was binge watching Bravest Warriors, and it's like there's a few things that struck me in that, and the first is, well, first of all, the music's amazing, as I said. And then the other thing is just like how frequently and how at the rate that you're switching, like genre switching and mood switching and sound switching, and just like everything is changing. It's like going to a restaurant and having the most like high level cuisine served to you at like lasers, and it's all tiny little amuse-bouche.
Yeah.
It's just going like, oh, you better finish that quickly because the next one's coming up, and you're like, oh, okay. Next one. And it's super entertaining and wonderful, but they just go by so blindingly fast. And I just go, I don't know how I would survive that. I don't think I could do it. What's your process for doing that? Like, how do you chunk that out and then go from something like, you're doing this like second golden age Jerry Goldsmith kind of fully legit massive orchestral sound, doing like space sci-fi stuff, and then bam, you're into like the most juicy 8-bit video game referencing, really well produced like stuff. Like, how does what is the workflow on that? Like, how does your brain even compute that?
Well, I get to work at the beginning of the day. And I stare at my empty logic session and I panic. I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do?
Okay.
That's only half the truth.
Right.
It's honestly, and I don't think I said this before, but animation music is significantly harder than I ever thought.
Okay.
You know, because of stuff like this.
Yeah.
You just have to turn on a dime all the time and output a million different cues.
Yeah.
So for me, the first few months of the show is the hardest
because
nothing exists.
Yes.
You're building everything.
Okay.
Nothing can hit music editorial yet. So you can't be like, oh, this action sequence would work great here if I just edited it. Like,
none
of that exists yet. So every single start has to happen. And yeah, I have these insane spreadsheets and I'll plot out which ones are orchestra, which ones are chiptune, which ones are 70s, which ones are 80s, which ones are late 80s, you know.
Oh my God.
And though I'll build my templates based on those.
Okay.
And do all the orchestra stuff in one. I
can
do all the chiptunes in another.
Yep.
And but even then, like, especially when we're getting to those kind of micro specifics of genres and stuff, like, I have to research that stuff sometimes because I'm like, well, I know the chiptune stuff because I kind of grew up with it,
mm-hmm.
but I was too young to appreciate some of the early 80s stuff.
Right.
So I just got to go on a listening bender for a little bit.
Okay.
So usually the first few weeks after I won that pitch, actually, I was just staring at YouTube for days. But like, okay, 80s greatest hits, you know, and it's more just analyzing the engineering.
Yeah.
How does that snare sound different from the 90s versus the 70s versus what kick drums are they using? What drum machines existed? What didn't?
Yeah.
You know, I had one producer who got really specific. He's like, I want to make sure that some of them have Roland MT32 sound module in it.
And I'm like, what?
That's the most specific reference, but
holy, and that's so nerdy
but
too.
Thank
wow.
you. Because then in a weird twist of coincidence again, that's the first sound module I ever used in grade 9 because our music class had it.
Okay.
So I remember I was like, oh yeah, you got to hold down shift and press a key to pick the MIDI channel. That thing was terrible.
Oh wow.
But I remember the sound of it. So I instantly knew some of the like the cheesy sound presets because I actually used one of those things.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So it was just kind of going down these research black holes. If I hadn't been a synth person to begin with, I would have been sunk.
Yeah.
You know?
How does that process work for you when you hear something? Because again, like one of the things I find amazing about orchestration that is a little underappreciated, I think, is that if you, especially with like classics, right? You want to know how Stravinsky did it? You can find a book and it's literally written down
it's written out.
A blueprint.
Yeah.
You want to do it exactly. You want an effect like that? Great. Just lift that directly. With like production, there's no blueprint. You have no idea what you can guess. Maybe like, I think they had this, they recorded it at such and such student and they had these compressors and they probably ran it through this and that, but you don't really know.
No.
And then crazy stuff like the Phil Collins snare, gated snare sound is like, that's
a mistake,
pop back,
right?
You know,
yeah.
It's like, it's not even supposed to be. So
I'll share one of my, my tricks
juicy.
And it's so stupid, but it's so effective. If I'm listening to a piece of music and I'm like, how do they do that? Like engineering wise.
Yeah.
I'll just flip one side out of phase and sum it, and then you'll just hear all the stereo effects. I'll be like, that's the reverb. The vocal's gone. Okay, I can hear that. That's a plate.
Wow.
I can hear it's a plate. It's not a hall. It's like, or it's like a gated thing. Oh, and there's chorus on the vocal because I hear it like trickling through. It's such a simple thing.
That's amazing.
But like, I even do that now for modern tracks.
Sure.
And it gets funny with modern stuff because a lot of stuff is flat out mono, except for like some vocal doubling. But especially the 80s stuff, it's a godsend because I can hear what stereo.
Yeah.
And if it's stereo, it's like, okay, to make it sound that way, I got to make sure my synths are panned out in stereo.
Got it.
And the kick has a little bit of a thing because I hear it.
Oh, that's so cool.
You know, I use that all the time.
That's a great tip.
And also I'd go into like Wikipedia and Synthtopia and be like, okay, if it's from this period of the 80s, what synths actually existed at that point?
Oh,
you know,
so
I can't use something from the 90s because that didn't exist yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the same thing would happen. They'd want 90s kind of stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
So then it'd be, you know.
The other thing is you're not producing it lo-fi. Like you, like the chiptune stuff sounds so candy. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
It's candy coated and just like sounds so good.
And that's sort of a weird problem I run into too because everything has to sound different.
Yeah.
But in the scope of the show, it has to have a consistent glue to it.
Right.
So usually I'll mix it as I would, but everything kind of goes through the same mastering process.
Okay.
So even though it's completely different in genre, it will still have that same kind of glaze to it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like how Omnisphere has a glaze to it. Like every sound kind of, I'm like, oh, that's an Omnisphere sound.
Right, you know? Right.
It just has like a thing about it.
Okay.
So I just make sure for the whole show that the cues all have that kind of master processing on it.
Okay.
And usually it's like a Neve Summer and an SSL compressor and like an EQ and a little bit of sweetening reverb. Really simple.
Hmm.
But that sort of unifies everything.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah. Just going back to keeping track of all those cues.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of spreadsheets and like really detailed notes.
Right. How do you approach your orchestral stuff? Because it's like, I'm listening to, like, it's the fun thing for me too, is like, I'm sort of watching the show and I kind of course, I get lost in the story. And I'm like, wait, I'm supposed to listen to music. And then I'm getting into the music and then I'm starting to like, trying to analyze like some of the motions, like the harmonic progressions you're getting into. I'm like, what is that even right now?
That's what I always wonder.
Yeah.
As we talked about earlier, I'm not traditionally trained or anything. Yeah. I've always been an ear guy.
Okay.
I've always been keyboard player in a band, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I know my theory, but I go by instinct when doing that kind of thing. So wow. I know this always gets craft people really mad. But
why?
I don't know, but they're like, you're not doing it by the book or whatever. And I'm like, well, I never had the book, so I'm just doing, I'm doing what I'm doing.
I don't
doing.
Think the book exists.
Well, it can exist, but does that musically convey properly for a show?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so sometimes I'm just, I don't want to say it like this, but sometimes I'm guessing. I'm like, you know what? If I layer these two things together, that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't. But in the scope of this scene,
yeah,
that sounds awesome. And when I add the synth to it, it sounds even cooler. Some of it, I can honestly say it's dumb luck. Sometimes I have a plan right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I've sort of sketched out something. I'll just hum something into my phone while I'm driving.
Uh-huh.
I'll have my rhythm. I'll have my motif or whatever.
Yeah.
And I know exactly what I want to do. I love those days where I'm like, I know exactly what this cue needs to be.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, it's always the really long action sequences. I love writing those. I find them really easy. And it's all the short stuff that kicks my ass.
Really?
Yeah. Like if I have to do, there might be a situation where it's jumping between two scenes in parallel.
Yeah.
And the music has to keep following what's happening. And then there's like a turnaround where it goes like, and then it marks a thing and then it marks something else. And then there's a transition.
Yeah.
That's all one thing.
Yeah.
And those take a lot of time.
Yeah.
Whereas an action piece, you can hit the beats, but it's easy to orchestrate it because you have time.
So one of the cool things about this production style in terms of the Bravest Warriors is this, you know, you can go a lot of really weird places with it. It's a very kooky show. And you have all these sort of like wonderful cues where you're really filling in that color and sort of, you know, you can go very strange places with it and it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it often doesn't make sense if you hear it by itself.
Right.
You're like, what is this? But I mean, context is everything.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You were mentioning one cue where it was like several different time signatures or like something going on where it was like everything at once.
Yeah. And you know what? It was a total accident too. You're presented with a scene and you're like, what am I going to do here? And I was just basically the scene was they get stung by this weird thing and they're all kind of dizzy and like their perception of time is all wacky.
Yeah.
So I was like searching for some weird sounds and I ended up just laying some stuff out in different tempos that just mashed like different time signatures and speeds and it just created this weird dizziness. And I was like, actually that's it. And when you watch it in context with the show, you're like, okay, yeah, I see why this is working. And then when you listen to it by itself, you're like, that's some weird shit going on.
So, you know, you've outlined this interesting career trajectory of yours, and it's really interesting to see sort of how it's all worked itself out. And I think it makes an interesting point too, because we were sort of laughing before we started recording about your lack of self-promotion. And I guess you don't really have to do that at this point because what you've got going sort of speaks for itself and you've got people that come to you and it's sort of like, it's again, like you were saying, meeting you know, Nicholas Dodd or hanging out in the cafeteria essentially and just knowing all these people, it creates its own kind of energy for what you're doing. It
creates energy, but I'm not getting work from those people.
Not now. You know? But well, I think it, you know, it's like you're obviously keep getting stuff and things go, you know, you're known and that's
I think it's one of those kind of dangerous things, right? Because I'm terrible at self-promotion.
Yeah.
And then when I'm like, okay, I'm going to redo my website and I'm going to do all this stuff. That's when I get busy on a show.
Sure.
And then I don't have time to do it. Yeah. And then rinse, wash, repeat. And like years go by.
Yeah.
And then I'll just think to myself, oh, I should really get on that. And it's always on my list.
Yeah.
And I just don't have a chance to because I'm swamped. And so on one hand, I'm lucky because I have a lot of repeat clients.
Mm-hmm.
But what if that doesn't happen?
Well, but what if?
No. Yeah, yeah. I'm more on the what if. Yeah, but sure. If what if not, yeah. Then I guess I would be starting from the beginning. Oh, hello, I exist. Hi.
Well, not really. Everyone knows. I think everyone knows you because you've got this like energy. They're just out there anyway.
But I mean,
plus everyone knows your cat.
I know it's true. But I honestly think I could have done better with self-promotion.
We could have all done better.
Now. Oh, you're amazing at self-promotion. Come on. What are you talking about?
Every time you say that to me, I feel like vaguely insulted. Like it's a bad thing.
Using your handsomeness as a tool.
Oh,
come on.
Shut up.
No, I admit that I have been pretty lax on the self-promotion front, and it's always on my list of things to improve, and I keep trying, but the productions that I'm working on are more important because I have to get them done in the moment. And
well, let me ask you this then, because you did start being a YouTube personality, aka McDonald's professional.
You know, there's something to be said about complaining on the internet.
Okay.
I think the internet is just designed for complaining. That's how that happened. I just arbitrarily was like, you know what? I'm just going to talk about this thing.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of...
It blew up.
It blew up in a weird way.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of strange emails from people.
I can't imagine.
But I've met a lot of interesting people too.
Yeah.
All over the world.
Yeah.
They're like, if you're ever in Switzerland or if you're ever here, like come to the studio.
You know? Like, I mean, you inadvertently cracked the code in a way of how do you go viral with something? Like what do you think it is that people connected with? Like, why do you think that stuff went the way it did?
I think it did because... those videos are like, I'm talking to you now.
Yeah.
I'm not putting on a persona.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what you think. No, I think it's what you see is what you get. There's no bullshit.
Yeah.
There's no glaze. There's no like sparkle bubble sunshine stuff. It's just like, here's this thing. Here's what I think about it. Here's my honest take as a working professional.
Yeah.
Like it or hate it,
here's
my view.
But it was such a niche thing, too. It was like such a specific.
I know.
Because what was it? It was something about an Apple product.
It was the first Mac Pro that came out in almost 8 years. And I just happened to have the first one in the field and have time to just quickly do a review of it.
Right.
But it was from a realistic thing. It wasn't like, this is shiny.
Yeah.
And you can do your email with it. No, it was like, here's the things that are cool about it. Here's the things I don't like about it, just as an observation.
Yeah.
And I'll just document how it goes when I put this thing together in my studio.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with YouTube and Instagram and TikTok is that it's all this fakery.
Yeah.
You know, like the influencers will buy something, review it, and then just return it, you know? Where I'm actually using this thing. So I'm like giving you an honest take on it. You can disagree, but I know what my process needs more than you ever will as an outsider.
Well, a lot of the people that seem to have a problem, like the trolls for most part, didn't even seem to like they took the time to quickly find out whether you were an actual composer or not.
You know,
they just sort of started attacking you in the strangest way.
And I think I even mentioned it early on in one of the videos. I'm like, listen, I've dealt with Hollywood people. There's nothing you can say to me. There's nothing you can say to me that's going to insult me. Like someone was like, you and your anime guitar metal neck beard. I'm like, great.
That's so specific.
Yeah, I was like, I'm glad you took the time to really think things over.
Yeah,
like,
that's it.
Are you okay?
Yeah. Are you okay? Yeah, you like, want to say that to people sometimes.
I mean, it's just, I find it interesting. I mean, I don't actively spend time doing it. It's just if I'm in the mood and I have a lull, I'm like, oh, you know what? I could talk about this and I'll just bang out a video really quick.
Yeah.
There's no plan or I think you even mentioned one time that it's like there's no consistency to anything you talk about.
I don't think I would have said that. That doesn't sound like me.
Maybe it was Russell.
Sounds like Russell.
Yeah. No, it's just a side thing and I can happily say that I make $100 a month.
Not bad.
So it pays for about 2/3 of my internet.
Not bad. I mean, if you make any money at all on YouTube, that's saying something.
The weirdest thing for me was just how people would reach out. I received emails from some engineers from some pretty heavyweight Hollywood composers asking me about, like, how did you do that stem out system? You know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, you guys have all the resources in the world.
Yeah.
You're contacting me. This is very bizarre. You know? And one time I was like, Logic's being weird with this. And like, a high-up developer at Apple emailed me directly. They're like, we want to talk to you next week.
Whoa.
I'm like, whoa, there is somebody out there? Because Apple's always been a one-way street.
Sure.
Like, they just push out stuff and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been interesting. And I've had the odd time a company will be like, hey, can we send you some like stuff to review? Is that review completely in my control? And they're like, well, not completely. And I'm like, don't want it.
Yeah.
You know? I'll tell you who it was after this.
Neil Parfit values his freedom.
If I can't say how I really feel. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, why? No. Because if I was talking to anybody in the real, I'd be like, this thing's great. That thing's great. But this, it has this stupid feature that will drive you crazy. Anyway, we're going off the rails with that. But
any parting words or thoughts, things that have been on your mind, obsessing you?
I've had a lot of composers, you know, just starting out, reaching out to me, being like, how did you get into this? What's the, what's the magic way? Like, what's the, and I think, and we were talking about this too, and I think it's the same for everybody. There's no magic bullet answer. Just do what you do well.
Yeah.
And just hustle it.
Yeah.
I
find your own lane.
Yeah. Find your voice. I'm content with the fact that I write silly, cheesy kids music. You know, that's what I do. I like it. I have fun. I see my niece and nephew laugh at things I've worked on.
Oh,
like,
that's great.
That's cool.
Like, yeah.
So yeah, I think find your voice and just keep at it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get too worried about what other people think.
Yeah.
Because no one's on the same path as you.
Yeah.
So I used to get really disheartened early on. I'd be like, oh man, like Andrew's recording at Abbey and doing all this stuff. And he's like, dude, like, you're paying for your house with your anime music. Like, what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, that's actually a good point. Like, it's, you know, you do your thing. I do my thing.
That's right.
Yeah. As long as I'm happy doing this.
That's right.
That's all that matters to me. And for me, that's what success is.
Yeah.
You know, money helps obviously because it helps you survive. But I think success is being happy with what you're doing.
The entertainment business is weird that way. I've been thinking about this for a while. Like, you know, I was talking to my sister-in-law in Edmonton and she's an OT and I just sort of realized like, oh yeah, you got educated, you got this job and now you just go do that job and your success is determined on how much you help your patients and how, like, you could measure it based on how much they like you and your overall success. And if you get along with your coworkers and there's all these measurements of success, but you don't look to other people and go, oh man, she was the occupational therapist to this amazing person. And then she like got this award. And then she like works at this, it's like the best hospital in Hollywood. And like, she's flies all over. And like, there's no, everyone just goes to a normal ass job. And then they go, yeah, this is good. I feel fulfilled and I do good work.
Yeah, it's like,
but we have this like insane business that we work in. We're always like looking at these shiny things and thinking that we're less than because we don't have.
And you know what? To be honest, I'm jealous a lot of the time of non-music friends because they're like, yeah, you know, on Thursday, we're just going to like fuck off to the cottage. And I'm like, weekends? What is this weekend thing I've heard of? I have to. And they're like, what are you doing on the weekend? What I do every weekend.
Yeah.
Work.
Take over the work.
Yeah.
We love what we do. I think that's the main part of it, right? Like it's an incredible position. It's a position of privilege, really, to be able to do this kind of stuff.
I agree, yeah.
Get up every day and be able to make music, to create, just to create. My mom always says, like, you did all that. You just, this came out of your brain. Like, you just made this stuff out of your brain.
And I actually had that happen. I did one of my friends runs a piano school, and I was their guest of honor 1 year. And, you know, I was showing them like some animation clips and things and like a sketch and then the final production. And a parent came up to me after and she's like, so where does the music come from then? And I'm like,
there's an answer.
And I just said, what do you mean? She's like, well, where do you get it? Like, do you get it off the internet or something? I was like, no, it comes from my brain. And she was just like, what?
But then I'd want to ask her, like, but if I got it from the internet, where did it come from before there?
Right.
It's like, where does the universe come from?
Well, that would be
before there was nothing. What was in the nothing?
And then it's like this piano recital got very interesting all of a sudden.
Neil?
Yes.
I'm not going to ask you where people can follow you online because you're not online very much.
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
I am online. I'm always on my Instagram and I'm on Facebook all the time. But yeah, I am the worst self-promoter of all time.
Well, if people want to follow you, where can they find you?
They can find me on Instagram.
Okay.
Just at Neil Parfitt. And they can find me on Facebook. I think it's just facebook.com/Neil Parfitt. I think YouTube, it's the same. It's just youtube.com/Neil Parfitt.
See, you did that part. Absolutely brilliant work there where you got the same handle for everything.
You know, it's interesting because I know my name. Oh yeah, and I mean, I have my website with no music on it, which I'm gonna work on. I'm serious.
All right.
Coincidentally, www.neilparfit.com.
There it is. Neil, this has been a total pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for the interrogation.
All right.
No. It's been great. I've laughed. I've cried.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll see you around, man.
All right.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes and tagging us at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. The Screen Composers Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Editing, graphics, audio, and video post-production by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as the SOCAN Foundation for financial support.